Hello, everyone. Thanks for listening into episode 28 of the Farm Middle Podcast. If this is your first time listening, welcome. My name is Nick Deolius. And if you've been a constant listener, thanks for investing the time once again. And you know by now that we kick off each episode by dedicating the episode number to an athlete of note. And for episode number 28, we could have picked from a group of awesome running backs. Could have chosen Adrian Peterson, Curtis Martin, Marshall Faulk. All of them great players, all of them Hall of Famers, of course. I guess my favorite would be Pittsburgh native and great Curtis Martin. Always loved him, even when he was tearing up for the despised Pitt Panthers being a Penn State guy. But instead, I want to go with someone else. I want to go with an intriguing and enigmatic individual from the world of baseball by the name of Burt Blyleven. Now, this guy is fascinating to me. He's a riddle wrapped within a puzzle. And there's an aspect of that that's with respect to what he did on the field and an aspect with regard to how he handled himself off the field. So first, let's talk about what it was like on the field. Burt Blyleven had the second most devastating curveball in the modern era. Only Sandy Koufax's curve was superior. And Blyleven, he knew how to strike out a batter. He could do that quite easily. In fact, he amassed over 3,700 strikeouts in his career, which places him fifth on the all-time list. And I looked up that all-time list before the podcast. Only some guys that you might have heard of, guys by the name of Nolan Ryan, Randy Johnson, Roger Clemens, and Steve Carlton, they're the only ones who have more strikeouts than Blyleven. And Burt Blyleven has more strikeouts than Walter Johnson, Bob Gibson, and Tom Seaver. I mean, there's three pitchers for you where he's actually got more strikeouts than those three greats. He was the American League Rookie Pitcher of the Year, and he first appeared in the majors when he was 19 years old. He also pitched a no-hitter, and he's a World Series champion two times over. But what's really intriguing to me about Blyleven is what he did or how he was off the field and his demeanor and his approach to the game. He was quite a handful. First, I guess the first thing that stands out is he really liked to have some fun at the expense of his teammates. He was famous for lighting their shoes on fire. And for a while, the Angels in their dugout placed a label on their fire extinguisher that read, "In case of Blyleven, pull." But he wasn't always fun to be around. In fact, he could be downright surly, and he could wear out his welcome on a team. That's why, in part, he played for so many teams in his career. He played for the Twins, where he started, the Rangers. He played for my Pirates. He played for the Indians. He went back to the Twins again, and I think he wrapped up his career with the Angels. So he played for a whole series of teams. And you get the feeling that his approach and his attitude was a big reason why he got shuffled around a lot. He was unhappy with his salary when he started out with the Twins as a young player, and he was promptly dealt. He threw a no-hitter for the Rangers when he was playing for them, and then he gave the finger to a national TV audience, and then he was traded and dealt again. And that was a first in Major League history, the first being, of course, traded after a no-hitter, not for giving the finger to a camera. He left the Rangers, went to the Pirates, and I remember that trade as a kid. I was probably, 10 years old at the time. And I didn't like the trade at the time in my 10-year-old mind because I loved Al Oliver, and Scoops Al Oliver was traded away to get Blyleven. But you know what? I learned to like that trade pretty quickly because he delivered for the Pirates, Blyleven that is, leading the pitching corps and helping to win the 1979 World Series. But true to form, right, he had a falling out with the Pirates. And he basically, from what I recall, he quit the team for a while during the 1980 season, midseason. It caused a lot of friction with teammates and with management. And then he was ultimately, probably in part because of that, dealt in the offseason to the Cleveland Indians. And he didn't like the losing nature of the Indians at the time. He then demanded a trade from them. He ended up in Minnesota again, where he won another World Series ultimately in 1987, I believe. So Burt Blyleven, he has all the stats and accomplishments to deserve his Hall of Fame stature, but I dedicate this episode to him because, to me, he would be an intriguing guy to talk to about baseball and his career over a couple of beers. I've got a feeling he would be more than entertaining and would not hold back on his views in any way, shape, or form. And he looks to me to represent where sports and pro athletes were heading. More of the me and less of the team. More control of career and less at the whim of the owner or ownership or the league. And I suppose that there's good and bad in that for sure. We see the good in it. We see the bad in it. But Blyleven, to me, was a harbinger of the modern day star. In many ways, I think he's the precursor to someone like Aaron Rodgers that you see today. And Blylevin sets us up nicely for the theme of episode number 28 of The Far Middle, the theme of how things are a-changing. If we start our string of connections on the theme of changing with the thought of Bert Blylevin and how he was a precursor to what was to come with the professional athlete thinking me first, we could connect it to another dot also centered on baseball. And that's the topic of how the game has changed in some of its most fundamental components and attributes. The concept and utilization of the starting pitcher is a great example of this. Not long ago, one of the badges of honor and key statistics baseball experts and fans alike looked to when judging great starting pitching was the complete game. Could the guy on the mound go the distance and deliver a complete game? If he could, that was a valuable and coveted asset for sure. Now, to put in perspective how much has changed in a very short period of time with starting pitchers and complete games, and thus baseball, because that's such an important piece of it, let me give you two comparisons that I think are really stunning. First, we just talked about and covered Bert Blylevin. In his career, he pitched 242 complete games, and he never won a Cy Young Award. In 2019, Blake Snell won the American League Cy Young Award for Tampa Bay, and he did so without ever appearing on the mound in the ninth inning of that season. In fact, I went back and looked, Blake Snell, across his entire professional career, has posted zero complete games. That's perhaps the best pitcher in baseball, never finishing or closing out a game in the major leagues. And then second, consider this contrast. This is even more of a striking one. The current active pitcher who holds the most career complete games is Justin Verlander. He's amassed 26 complete games over his 15-year career. So if you look at all active pitchers, the guy that's got the most complete games career is Verlander, 26, and he played 15 years to get the 26 complete games. Now, that's the career leader, again, of all active Major League Baseball pitchers. Bob Gibson, in 1968 and in 1969, twice, he pitched 28 complete games in each season. So Gibson achieved more complete games in a single season twice than the current active career leader has done over 15 seasons. Amazing. So the times are a-changing in baseball, as is the case in much more important things in life. And just a question for you, I guess, while we're on this dot, who would you rather see pitch? Bert Blylevin or Blake Snell, Bob Gibson or Justin Verlander? I think I know the answers, which tells you that not all change is going to be for the best. Now, the times are also changing on college campuses, and this leads us to our next dot, because this change or these changes on college campuses might be one for the better. Now, I managed to get out again, despite the best intentions of those around me to box me in. I managed to bust out, and I spent some time on a college campus recently. I'm not going to name the college, but the specific campus is really not as important as what I observed, because I think you're going to see this across a range of different colleges and universities. And I think much of what I saw is not unique to changes across an individual campus as much as it is being experienced across many, if not all of them these days. It's more of a cultural shift, or maybe a response to, a reaction to a prior set of cultural shifts set about by the administration and faculty and so on. And I would categorize my observations of how students are starting to wise up to the ridiculous and irrational when it comes to the culture of academia these days. That may precipitate needed change sooner rather than later, and I'd certainly welcome that for one. Now, the first thing that I noticed on this visit is how the campus was completely insulated from what was going on literally across the street in the real world. And this was a pretty well-known university, got a great legacy, a great history, and it's situated directly adjacent to a bustling commercial district in a decent-sized town. So when you're on the town side, everyone's walking around without masks, restaurants are full, people are freely interacting with one another, sort of life is what you would expect it to be and want it to be. Now you cross the street, and the minute you step foot on the campus, everything changes. The entire vibe shifts. Most people are wearing masks, even outside. And I learned that the school just lifted its mandate of mask wearing outside a few short weeks ago, but the mandate to wear them inside remains. And by the way, the school claims, like most colleges and universities, a really high vaccination rate. I think this school was somewhere north of 95% for both students and faculty, which sort of brings into question, I guess, the whole medical scientific need for masks, but nevertheless, the mandate was in effect. And since everyone has to wear masks indoors, Many don't remove them when going outdoors on campus, which then results in no one talking to one another. So this creates two distinct feels, right? You've got the vibrant, bustling town and the austere, oppressive campus literally rubbing right up against one another. And you could feel yourself wanting to leave the campus and return to the town just across the street, which is a shame. It sort of felt like what each side, I guess, of the Berlin Wall must have felt like back in the day. What a harsh contrast that left me wondering how students and faculty felt, you know, living or working in one world and looking across the street and sensing a totally different one. Now, the second thing that I noticed was how students are voting with their checkbooks in small steps, literally steps. So like a lot of schools and universities, this one had a part on the campus in the quad where there were those stones in the pavement that commemorated individuals or graduating classes from the past. You see these all the time, right? So, you know, you donate some amount of money and then there's a stone or a brick in the ground that's got your name or your class stamped on it. At this campus, there were large paving stones in a main walkway that started with the class of around 1990. And then each sort of paving stone progressed through each class, ending with the class of 2020. Now, making things more interesting was that each stone, which stated, you know, quote, the graduating class of whatever year, end quote, also had stamped on it the percent of the senior class that participated in donating to the memorial. So for the years in the 1990s and through the early 2000s, the participation rate for the graduating seniors that was stamped on these stones, it was floating somewhere at a high level between the 70s, 80s, and some years it was even in the 90 percentages. What got really interesting was when you walked up on the 2019 and 2020 stones, because for these two, the participation rate shown on the markers, it plummeted from the prior years and sat in the 30s for 2019, I believe, and in the 20s, some 20-some-odd percent for the year 2020. Now, those two flagstones, they told me a lot, the 2019 and 2020 ones. The culture of academia and how that culture ends up making things worse through things like COVID and shutdowns is starting to take its toll on those customers, which are the students and their parental funding sources. And they're expressing their displeasure through their participation in small things, or lack of participation, I should say, in small things physically, but large things optically, like those flagstones. Now, the third item I came across in my observations on campus during this visit was a community message and thought posting board located in an accessible open location. So this is one of those places, you've seen them on every college campus and university. It's one of those places that you see where anyone can go up and write something or post something with respect to thoughts, opinions, or views. It might be a big whiteboard, it could be a chalkboard, it could be a bulletin board. They vary from place to place, but the idea is the same. And actually, I think it's a great idea for a place that's supposed to be the marketplace of ideas. So it's actually a perfect type of a tool or a sort of a conversation starter for a place like a college campus. Now, this one that I saw had a range of items posted on it, but about half the board was occupied by a movement and a plea for the school to divest the fossil fuels. And it was clearly organized and laid out in a fashion where it was not organic or a series of postings from different individuals. But instead, this was something put together by some organization looking to sway minds. And of course, it got my attention, being who I am and what I do and how I'm passionate and interested in all things energy related. And then I noticed it. So in the corner, under one of the panels that was carefully constructed by God knows what environmental group that doesn't have a clue when it comes to energy policy, sat the words of, I guess, what an individual had thought and scrolled, who clearly read the board, and they picked up the writing instrument and weighed in. And the words that were down in the corner there were, under sort of divest of fossil fuels now, were the words, quote, go ahead and then let's all freeze in the damn dark, end quote. I could not have said it better. And for those of you who are wondering, no, I did not write or post anything on that board. I wouldn't do that on a college campus. I think that's a platform for students to weigh in on, not outsiders. Too bad whatever organization had fabricated the divestment panels when it comes to fossil fuels didn't exercise the same level of respect. Might it be, when you start looking at that dynamic of this message board or thought board, might it be that students are starting to think a little bit rationally when it comes to energy policy and the times they are a-changing when it comes to that? Now, the one thing that isn't changing on college campuses is a complete lack of accountability to the student customer and to their experience. I saw at yet another school that the entire past week of Thanksgiving was given off to the administrative staff at the school to express gratitude for their work. So the head of the university decided it was time for a week's worth of gratitude to the administrative staff of the school, gave them the entire week of Thanksgiving off, and not the students. The students didn't get the week off because they needed to attend class for part of the week. Class was in session. And not the faculty, because the faculty needed to teach the classes that the students were attending. But this is for exclusively the administrative bureaucrats, the ones that create all this complexity and drama and higher tuition on campuses. Now, this is coming off of, mind you, two school years where the bureaucracy got to work at half speed in their sweats and from their couches at full pay. Yep, let's give them a paid week off to express our gratitude. Well, thanks for nothing, university bureaucrat. At least with them staying home, I guess it'll limit some of the damage that they can dispense to students when hard at work. And speaking of thinking and academia, brings me to the next thought to connect on things that are a-changing, which is the morals and moral absolutes, or maybe I should say, increasingly the lack of moral absolutes that we see across our society. I got into this theme or this item when I was reading up recently that drugstores are closing and shuttering all over the Bay Area out in San Francisco. And they're doing this because of either organized or individual but widespread shoplifting. There's sort of an epidemic of shoplifting occurring in drugstores and other retailers all across the Bay Area. So one of the root causes of this is what's known as Proposition 47 in California. Prop 47 was passed a couple of years ago in California, and it basically says that shoplifters with less than $950 in stolen goods can't be prosecuted even if caught. So what happens when this becomes law, of course, is that the potential shoplifter knows that there's now no consequence if they're staying under a certain threshold, so they're more emboldened. Employees at these stores are basically told not to try to stop them from stealing, right, because of a whole range of issues from the safety of the employee to insurance and ultimately the customers covering this and higher costs. And of course, police are going to be less reluctant. Law enforcement will be less reluctant to catch the shoplifters because there's no consequence. They're not going to be prosecuted for it under Prop 47 if it falls under $950. Thus, an epidemic of shoplifting is occurring. And when it happens, organized shoplifting in drugstores and businesses like drugstores in places such as big cities like San Francisco and the Bay Area, it takes off. And Walgreens is one example, right? A major drugstore retailer says that it spends, I found this statistic to be amazing, it spends 47 times its national average for security in its San Francisco Bay Area stores. Now, when you spend that much more on an expense line item than you do elsewhere, that's going to hit margins, it's going to kill margins, and that ultimately is going to result in shuttering those stores. And that's exactly what's happening. Now, while all that's going on, that led me down the rabbit hole to another item within this theme, which is where today you've got more and more of these authors, many of them being celebrated and being supported by major media outlets that are saying, oh, this shoplifting and whatnot is fine, that it's cool. And I don't know if you know this or not, there's a book out there currently that everybody seems to be talking about in a, unfortunately, a good way. And the title of it is In Defense of Looting. So NPR, which is that tax dollar subsidized leftist outlet called a news outlet, right, has the author that wrote this book In Defense of Looting on as a guest. And they discussed how looting is okay because it helps catalyze social change and address things like inequality. So they're justifying it under sort of the broader context of those issues or those goals and objectives, which then sort of led me down to another sort of piece or part of that rabbit hole, which was when I stumbled on a podcast from Dennis Prager at the Prager University, who brought an interesting twist to this issue on how religion is being sort of contorted, even the most basic components of major religions with this type of a movement. It's sort of dissolving away the concept of moral absolutes, which many religions are basically founded upon a foundation of. And why is this all happening, from shoplifting to, you know, these ridiculous books with these ridiculous titles? Because there are no more moral absolutes. If you just think of something like the Ten Commandments, one key one being thou shalt not steal. Every kid was taught not long ago that stealing is wrong, period. You don't steal. But not anymore. Now it's thou shalt not steal anything over $950 if you're looking at California and Prop 47. Or thou shalt not steal unless you can show it helps express frustration over an injustice. Now, one wonders after a while where all of this ends. Like, how far do you take this? Is society saying it is now okay to kill the innocent under certain situations? You know, what other of the Ten Commandments are going to be suspect or, you know, subject to an asterisk by it where you got to read the fine print? I guess the Ten Commandments ain't what they used to be. Yep, the times are a-changing for sure. And this brings me to my last thought to connect under the theme of this podcast, which is the times they are a-changing. And that is Bob Dylan. Since a few episodes ago, when I mentioned that Dylan was coming again to Pittsburgh and I might check him out, people have been emailing me asking me if I did attend the concert here that occurred in mid-November in Pittsburgh and what it was like. So I have to report for everybody whether I did, of course I did, and then what I observed. Look, he played a great but smaller venue outside Pittsburgh where he's played before. Last time I saw him actually was at the same venue just outside of Pittsburgh. And the reason he plays these smaller venues, you see, is that Dylan does what he wants, not what the press or the fans or social media dictates. So Dylan wanted this tour to play a lot of songs from his recent album, Rough and Rowdy Ways, which, by the way, is an excellent Dylan album. It's one of his best, more recent albums. And this was not a greatest hits tour, which meant it was going to attract a smaller, more core audience on the tour itself. Thus, he played the smaller out-of-the-way venues. And when he does that, I think it's awesome. You get a much more better, intimate feel for him in the smaller venues. He comes across much better. And I attended this Dylan concert. Like, I have all the Dylan concerts that I've attended. I think I've been to maybe five or six through the years recently. And I attended with a buddy of mine who I always see Dylan with. He's the guy that actually got me turned on to Dylan Live probably about 15 years ago. And he always goes to these Dylan concerts with two friends of his who are just experts, aficionados when it comes to Bob Dylan. They sort of got doctorates or PhD in Bob Dylan. And they are as entertaining as Dylan himself at these shows because they're always weighing in between songs and before and after the sets to tell you what they're seeing and how they view it. And they add an element that's really cool to the overall concert experience. So it was great to attend with those guys as well. And the place itself, the venue, was about two-thirds full this night. I'm sure COVID had an impact on this, and I'm sure that Monday night, having a Monday night date for the concert also had an impact. And I will tell you, I was on the younger side of the audience for sure. I'm in my early 50s, but I was a young pup compared to some of the people who were there. But that's pretty representative of Dylan's following and who he attracts when he goes out on tour. Now, his band, as always, it was really tight, very talented. Like the audience, Dylan attracts a certain musician to play in his bands through the years. These guys were, I think, worth the price of admission on their own, just the band alone, the backing band. Now, does Bob Dylan still have it? I brought this up in a prior episode of The Far Middle, the Rolling Stones. People saying that they saw the Rolling Stones recently on their stadium tour, they still got it. And I made the point, no, they don't still have it. They're pushing 80 years old. Whenever you get to that age, you're not going to have it. You're going to have to, like you used to, you're going to have to make adjustments. It's a different product altogether than what you were doing when you're in your 20s or 30s or 40s. That's just the reality of an athlete. That's the reality of a musician because of the physical changes in the human body. So I always, you know, sort of grin when I hear people say, oh, I saw the whatever act, Rolling Stones, whoever, they still got it. No, they have something, but it's not what they used to have. So does Bob Dylan still have it? The reality is yes, right? It's interesting with Dylan, but in the context of an 80-year-old Dylan, that's what he's got, not the freewheeling Bob Dylan of the 1960s. So his examples I'll give you here, his guitar playing days, they're over. And he spent most of the show behind a piano playing away and did a really great job doing it. And when he did stand up to sing, which he did during certain songs, he had one hand on the mic stand and one hand on the piano for support. That's what happens when you're 80 years old and you're touring in a live sort of performance. And since he was playing mostly his new album, that he recorded during this era and during this age that he's in, guess what? He didn't have to tune down anything. So you never have to worry about something like auto track with Bob Dylan. It is what it is. And he's out there being who he is, 100% authentic at 80, voice imperfections and all. And again, the fact that he was playing a lot of the songs in the set from his newer album, which was recorded when he was pushing 80, right? He didn't have to adjust much with respect to his delivery, which was awesome. Now, something that was pretty cool about this concert, Dylan interacted with the audience probably the most I've seen him do in all the times that I have seen him live. Now, that doesn't mean he was exactly conversational. This is Bob Dylan, after all, so don't forget that. But a few thank yous and a whatnot showed that he was having a good time that night, and I think that was good to see. In terms of the set list, the best new song for me that he played was off Rough and Rowdy Ways, that album that I referenced. It was titled I Contain Multitudes. Really good song. Give that a listen if you get a chance. And favorite song from the past that he played was most likely You Go Your Way and I'll Go Mine. That's off that classic album Blonde on Blonde. Really like that song. He did a great job on it. And that sort of brings up another interesting thing about concerts these days. Set lists today are published online after each city and show. So you know what you will likely hear going into the show, the songs, the order of the songs, everything. It's another example how times they are changing. And there's good and bad in that. Good, I guess, in that you enjoy what is coming more, right? Because you know what to expect. But bad in that the aura of mystery and surprise, what are they going to play next? What are they going to close with? That type of thing is gone. You pretty much know what you're getting walking into concerts these days. And you know, Bob Dylan, he tours all year long, right? He tours every year, all year long. He's been doing this for decades, not because he needs the money. He just sold his publishing rights for hundreds of millions of dollars. And I said, if it were only about the dollars, you know, he'd be doing the greatest hits shtick in the big arenas and stadiums. That's where the most money is to be had. And we know a bunch of other acts that we all know or are all well known that do that on a regular basis, trying to cash in. He doesn't do it because he wants to. No, he tours because it's something more complex than that. Dylan tours incessantly because he needs to. It's in his routine, and he's a man of routine. It keeps him straight, it keeps him calm, it keeps him focused, and I think it keeps him healthy. Now, when the show ended, I sat there for a while, and I watched the crew tear down the equipment and the stage. I always like watching that process run for the 100th time in 100th city. I guess it's the engineer in me, I suppose, to an extent, but you can just see that process where they've got this thing refined on how they tear down a stage, pack it up, and move on to the next place. And I sat there thinking how Dylan is such an enigma, sort of like Bert Blyleven in a lot of ways. People think they know his views and they know Dylan's positions on things, but he keeps that really close to his vest. And you're left to interpret what his thoughts are via his lyrics, and that leaves a lot open to interpretation. I think personally, if you want to ask me, I think Bob Dylan is a capitalist. Perhaps the song publishing rights sales that I mentioned was for estate planning purposes, so Uncle Sam doesn't eat it all. That's just sort of a guess on my part. But I walked out of that concert that night after I watched the crew tear down the stage for a while thinking that this might be the last time that I see Bob Dylan live. In this life and in this age, we shouldn't take anything for granted anymore. It's all the more reason, I think, to stand up for what is right and oppose what is wrong. Well, that now concludes episode 28 of the Far Middle Podcast. Till next time and next week, follow me on Twitter at Nick Deolius and check out some new postings on the website, nickdeolius.com. And as always, you take care.